This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Last spring on Cadenza, we ran a series of programs visiting with maestros not born in the U.S., but leading major U.S. orchestras. French conductors in Cincinnati and Seattle, a Finnish maestro in Minnesota, Nashville led by a Costa Rican-born conductor, and a Spaniard leading a cutting-edge ensemble in Washington, D.C. We'll add to that list this program as we visit with the Swiss-born maestro leading the Utah Symphony, Thierry Fischer. Mr. Fischer was actually born in the Federation of Rhodesia to Swiss parents. He had a very comfortable career as principal flutist in European orchestras such as Hamburg, the Zurich Opera. He studied with Aurelia Nicolet and Nicolas Harnoncourt, ending up as principal flute with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe under Claudio Abbado, where he caught the conducting bug, and it turned out that that was his calling. He started with the Netherlands Ballet, stints in Ulster, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, in Japan with the Nagoya Philharmonic Orchestra, and in 2009 became only the seventh music director of the Utah Symphony, an ensemble celebrating 75 years of music making. Utah and the symphony were foreign to him until he realized it was the orchestra that was led for decades by the great Maurice Bravanel, the first U.S. orchestra to record a complete cycle of Mahler symphonies. In fact, Bravanel's recordings of symphonies 7 and 8 were the first commercial recordings of those works. My guest just released a recording of the Symphony No. 8, and you're listening to the opening movement from Part 1, Veni Creator Spiritus. The soloists and the Utah Symphony and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir are led by my guest. This recording follows a first foray in the Mahler cycle of his Symphony No. 1. Maestro Fischer was charged with getting the Utah Symphony back to where it was when Abravanel was in front. Within my guest's first 36 months, there were 30 new players in the ensemble. He has combined the Utah Symphony with the Utah Opera, a rarity in the U.S., and to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the orchestra, they have released a new recording of three works commissioned by the Utah Symphony, and he's also appeared with his orchestra in Carnegie Hall to great acclaim. He is bonding not only with his Utah players, but with the community, taking the orchestra on tour around this scenic state and building a confidence and camaraderie that looks to continue for years since his contract has been extended through 2022. I spoke with Maestro Thierry Fischer late last fall. here today, very happy to be here today with Maestro Thierry Fischer. Congratulations on this next step of the Mahler recording cycle. Just a question, we jump from 1 to 8. Was 8 just expediency because you could get the Great Mormon Tabernacle Choir? Because there's a lot of Mahler territory in between. I'm just wondering why the progression of 1 to 8.
As you know, this Mahler cycle was part of a 2 years cycle celebrating our 75th anniversary. And there has never been a strong intention to record all the Mahler symphonies, from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We decided to prioritize our recording projects. During the same time, we were also recording the CD called Down to Dust with three American composers, and we will give us time to develop this recording project among others we are doing at the moment, like the complete Saint-Saëns symphonies we've started this season. And as you rightly said in your question, it's such an experience, a monumental experience, to put the forces for Mahler 8. Then having the Tabernacle Choir for this in this wonderful tabernacle in Salt Lake was an opportunity not to be missed in the terms of the vision of the recordings, because we probably won't be able to to do it very soon again. So as it was part of our cycle, we just decided to record it as we had the opportunity to do it.
Many might think that the American Mahler Orchestra might be the New York Phil. If you go back to Bernstein, the Chicago Symphony, go back to Schulte. Actually, it's Utah. You are the Mahler Symphony, because Abravanel conducted the first complete commercial cycle. He got awards from the Mahler Society, the Bruckner Society. It's really has been in the DNA, even if it has been a while since they've performed and recorded it until you came along. You've done cycles, like you said, of the Mahler for the 75th, and then you've done Beethoven cycle and Nielsen cycle. So you've talked interestingly about doing cycles, and it puts you psychologically, you and the musicians, deeply into the composer. I'm just, it's a few words just about the thought about doing symphonic cycles with a symphony like yours.
Yeah, to me, it's a crucial notion, is to put things in perspective artistically in terms of developing the sound structure of the symphony, the sound approach, and to be able to be at the same time totally involved in the composer's trajectory. And like a paradox, the more you are involved, the more you take distance, and gives you much more impact on what you are doing. When we perform in a season, all Beethoven symphonies in chronological order or not, you know, and we've done the same with Nielsen and Mendelssohn and now with Saint-Saëns, it just, you know, shows you sound-wise what composers are going through or did go through during their lives and their creative process. Because, of course, there are known symphony, fantastic symphony, less impressive symphonies, etc. So just enduring them, working on them on a very regular basis during the winter season, instinctively and without even noticing it, develop this direct way of producing sounds and pushes us to excellence.
It was interesting, I was reading something you said, how like when you're doing the Beethoven symphony, everybody thinks, well, you get inside the language of the composer, but actually the composer gets inside your body. You said you're like tapping rhythms, and you were even going in the shower. It almost takes you over when you're that immersed in it, which is an interesting perspective. One wouldn't think on your level that that might still happen, but it does, I guess, when you're totally immersed, right?
It definitely does. I mean, for all composers, and especially for Mahler, and especially for Mahler 8, which took a big part of my life to study and to understand both text. First, I started to really put the text in my brain before the music, because I wanted to understand the spiritual message of Mahler before the music of Mahler, which I was very familiar with. As you rightly suggest in your question, it very quickly became an obsession in my life, and I had, especially the weeks before the performances and the recording, I had to almost neglect and ignore and give less energy in my other projects. And I actually even cancelled a project a few weeks before the actual recording, because I needed to be alone with the score.
That kind of involvement and passion, you kind of brought on yourself. Our listeners would be fascinated, because you came to conducting quite late, and you were living, unexpectedly, I should say, you were living a very happy, comfortable life as a principal flutist in some major orchestras in Europe. And then by happenstance, you conducted and had kind of an epiphany. I'm just wondering if you could sort of recap that moment, because it really sent you on a different trajectory. Here you are, you turned 60 this year, so you're nearly half your life you've now been conducting. And if you could just relay the story, I think it's a fun story of how you came to the podium.
Yeah, as you say, I was so happy as a flute player. I was, you know, I was a very, very happy man. But, you know, life is full of surprises. And although I was attracted by the complexity of being a conductor and playing for all those great conductors, you know, I was always interested to see them acting, thinking, asking us to do things. And I had an opportunity totally unexpected in my life to replace somebody one day. And I know it is a cliche, but I can assure you it's a really true one. After 1 minute, I knew that my life was really changed, because I was going to be wanting to be a conductor from that exact moment. Mm. Suddenly, I felt this is my life project, literally in a few seconds. These kind of things cannot be prepared, cannot be imagined, and they just happen. That's what happened to me. And then it became very clear. It took just 2 years to quit the orchestra and start to have enough projects to have, you know, the possibility to have a living. And I was at the same time starting to have a family.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
Did you have to go home and have like a heart-to-heart with your flute and say, I'm really sorry about this, but, you know.
No, I mean, I took a sabbatical year from the Chamber Orchestra of Europe.
Yeah.
And I just did not come back, and I knew I was not going to come back. So the last concert I had with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, I remember very well. It was in the Musikverein in Vienna, playing Schumann symphonies with Franz Brüchen. And when I closed my flute box backstage after the concert, I was alone with myself, and I knew this was the last time. Hmm. And like a heavy smoker, you just said, you know, this is it. And for me, it was not toxic to be a flute player, of course.
No.
But it was taking all my energy, and I was just going to something else. But it was very natural and never regretted or hesitated. It was very clear.
Here is my guest in some flute music, but he's conducting, not playing the flute. This, the final movement Rondo from the Flute Concertino in G by Dutch-German late 18th, early 19th century composer Johann Wilhelm Wilms. The soloist is Jacques Zoon. The Netherlands Radio Chamber Orchestra is led by my guest today, Thierry Fischer.
Thank you.
The orchestra you lead has an interesting history, and it's kind of analogous actually to Philadelphia, which is just south of us, in that over its long tenure, you're the seventh music director of Utah. Some of the directors before you had not very long directorships, but for 30 of its years, of its nearly 80 years, one man conducted this orchestra, sort of like Ormandy with Philadelphia. I'm just wondering, when you came to first conduct, guest conduct Utah in 09, what you knew of the orchestra, what you knew of Utah, the state, the people. I mean, what did you know when you first stepped up on that podium?
To be honest, I didn't know a lot after about the Utah Symphony. And when I was approached, I was not incredibly enthusiastic to know more.
Yeah.
And then I did, as the orchestra insisted, a little bit of homework, very basic. And I realized this was Maurice Abravanel's orchestra. And of course, he was a legend as a music director because he was interested and he developed not only the level of the orchestra, but, you know, a whole educational program.
Right.
And he was very involved in what a symphony should be to have sense in a community. He was very known. I knew his name. I knew his recording career and everything. I even had a few recordings. So suddenly, as the orchestra insisted, I realized, oh, this is a Abravanel's orchestra, so maybe I should have a look. Why not? And I was also interested to know the American classical world a little bit more, so it was a first good introduction, having the history of Abravanel behind all that. I noticed that, you know, he's dead for a few years, but he's still there, believe me.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I met so many people who were appointed by Abravanel. The name is called the Abravanel Hall.
Right.
And I was, yeah, impressed by the, you know, the artistry. There was a lot of things to do to go back to those years, mm-hmm. which was the goal of the board, who approached me more seriously about the possibility to be music director. They definitely were dreaming about the Abravanel years and wanted to go back where he left the orchestra when he stopped conducting. So this was a very strong motivation. And with this clear vision of the board and their great support and motivation they gave me, I was very happy to start to create a new vision based on this very creative history of the orchestra.
And one thing you did, which if you look around other orchestras in the U.S., hasn't always gone smoothly, is you were able to make changes, personnel changes, repertoire changes. So there must have been, besides the relationships you were building, there must have been some kind of key in just how you handled this to make that successful. I mean, it's wonderful that it went that way because other cities had more stress, we'll put it that way, put it mildly, when things like that happened.
You know, it's all about the vision.
Yeah.
If an art organization wants to be alive and have a future and have your community support you because they need your sounds as much as they need an NBA team in basketball, you know, to have energy and inspiration in the city, then if we all aim for the same thing, for excellence, for inspiration, for sharing what sounds can bring in our spirits, in our brains, in our way of looking at each other, are hoping, are perceiving what we can be through sounds, then everything is not easy, of course not, but it's obvious. And then it's about leadership. And one after the other, I was able to take one decision after the other to develop simply the possibilities to have a future. And I did spend a lot of time talking to everybody at all levels in the organization about not the why of the decisions, but the how it will create the future. And as a music director, as a leader, it's very important to forget the so-called power you have and to transform this into a musical authority to create a new chapter for the organization. And I was very much inspired by Abravanel, who stayed, as you said, 30 years in the orchestra. And he created the generation of the people I found when I arrived here in Utah. But this was many years ago. So with the board, we felt that we were just at the moment where it was up to us to create the new generation. And everything happened, you know, moderately smoothly. Of course, when you take decisions, then you have people, of course, thinking you should take another decision. This is happening in every field, not only in a symphony. In businesses, education, in universities, in schools, in shops.
Yeah.
But I kept very strong, and I am still keeping very strong about the vision I am having, and I am so pleased to say we are now having, because the organization is very healthy at the moment. We have a great spirit, and we all want to continue to develop, because it is giving a sense to our lives, and more importantly, is giving hope to people who are supporting us.
I mean, you've been extended through 2022, so it's working, and it's so great to see it working in Salt Lake City with you. It's working in Seattle and Cincinnati. It's working in Nashville. I mean, where there's a real, real tight relationship, a beneficial and working and healthy and artful relationship happening between administrations, musicians, and the music director. It's great to see. It really is. My guest, Maestro Terry Fisher, had a very nice discography before the recordings he is now releasing with his Utah Symphony. Here on Deutsche Grammophon is music of his fellow Swiss compatriot, the great 20th century composer Frank Martin. This, the final movement from his 1949 Concerto for Seven Wind Instruments, Timpani, Percussion, and Strings, performed by members of my guest's old orchestra, where he was principal flute, and where he got his start conducting, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. You've embraced new music. You, of course, come from a Central European type of awareness of new music, but you've embraced American new music. One of the new recordings on reference, you said, Dawn to Dust, with music of Augusta Reed Thomas, Nico Moodley, and Andrew Norman. And this is important to you, that you commission a new work each year for the orchestra, that the symphony, that they have an experience not only of premiering a piece, but working with the composer. I mean, talk about this. This is something you feel very strongly about.
Yes, it is absolutely essential. An orchestra is not only a museum performing pieces everybody knows. I am aware of the importance of coming to a concert hall to be comforted by what we know, the famous melodies of the famous pieces of the repertoire. I noticed that this is not sufficient. You know, you don't go to the Louvre or the Met, Metropolitan Museum in New York, every week with a subscription looking at the same pictures, even if you like going once in a while. So it's not enough. To develop also as an audience member, you need diversity and elements which are allowing you to be able to compare and to enjoy even more some things and to hate even more some other things. And it's fine. The notion of art doesn't need to be having everybody happy all the time. I love controversy. It's much needed. I love people not liking what we do, and I love people loving what we do. And I love, this is meaning, very simply, having a creative energy around our organization. And then, obviously, I'm coming on your question. New music is an essential part of any modern symphony. And on top of that, spending every season a week with a composer, coming to the rehearsal, talking with the players, making talks with the audience or with the students at the university, and it creates a very, very positive atmosphere in the entire organization. Also backstage, or the marketing has to sell it, the marketing has to know more about the composer, and it gives an excitement in the whole building. Because everybody say, oh my God, we have a new premiere, you know. And so the intensity of the preparation is different than playing Beethoven 5 or Dvorak 9. Is not more, is not less, is just needed. And then putting excellence in the preparation and the performing way of doing new music is revitalizing and reinvigorating our impact and projection of Beethoven, Brahms, Dvorak. I strongly believe in it. And when I saw the symphony's reaction, the players, they felt, you know, very happy and honored to have composers writing for them. And very, very, the huge majority of the orchestra said that they did find a collective identity working for those composers, spending time to write for them, and coming into town. And then when you have this collective identity, then all the doors are open to go refreshed into Dvorak 9, Beethoven 9, and Rachmaninoff 2.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm glad that it's also that the focus is on American composers, and there's so much great
music. Yeah, this was very important to me because I started with European composers, because, of course, it was a bit of a challenge to find the money for having a commission every year.
Right.
And for the 75th anniversary, I really felt that also for me as an artist, I wanted to know the American culture, you know, what's going on with American composer. You know, I needed to feel that and to spend, you know, literally time with American composers.
Thank you.
So part of the Utah Symphony's 75th anniversary celebration was a recording they released called Dawn to Dust on the Reference Recordings label of three works commissioned by the Utah Symphony. Hear from Augusta Reed Thomas's Eos, Goddess of the Dawn. Let's hear the first three of its seven sections, these titled Dawn, Daybright and Firebright, and Shimmering. The Utah Symphony are led by their music director and my guest today, Terry Fisher.
Thank you.
So we just heard music of Augusta Reed Thomas, and before we wrap up our chat with my guest, let's dip once more into this recording called Dawn to Dust of three works commissioned by the Utah Symphony. From Nico Muhly's Control, Five Landscapes for Orchestra, we'll hear the final one, Red Dust. Once again, the Utah Symphony is led by their music director and my guest today, Maestro Thierry Fischer. our audience here knows the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra, and they're an interesting orchestra because they're a state orchestra, which means they play all around the state. So do you, but the difference is the New Jersey Symphony plays in different cities. You actually take the orchestra and you, on a seasonal basis, go out and play at some of the national parks and monuments around the state of Utah. It's a fascinating program. What's your thoughts about doing those?
It's extraordinary. We have this portable stage, you know, like on a massive truck. I mean, you should see us touring in several trucks following each other in the middle of the desert, and three coaches with the entire orchestra there. And you can only imagine the logistic about just having electricity and protection for the wind and potential rain. And the sceneries we are playing is just back to the basics of inspiration.
Yeah.
Because we play in the middle of the stars, you know, when you play in Bryce Canyon or Zion's Park or in totally unknown places like Bluff, you know, who heard about Bluff in Utah? It's in the middle of nowhere. But it's one of the most strong experiences we ever had because the audience which is coming there, it's for them a revelation. They have no idea about what it means to share the sound energy so directly. And just the fact that we are, you know, literally on the road. We're not, just not taking a plane and go to the hotel and then go to the concert hall and next morning we go somewhere else, as usually orchestra tours. And of course, we have been doing this a little bit and I hope we will be doing this much more in the future. But this being on the road as an artist, you know, putting your stuff in the middle of nowhere every night or every other night is a very, very special way of sharing music.
Yeah, we don't quite have those natural, beautiful vistas here in New Jersey that you have in Utah. Well, I should also say, as we close here, but you are a 21st century conductor. I mean, you do a little bit of jet setting. You are also the director of the Seoul Philharmonic in South Korea, and that's going well, I assume, even though there's a lot of miles in between. I assume that's all happening. Things are going well there, too.
Yeah, it's going very well. It's a very, very good orchestra, high level, and all the credit to my predecessor, Myeowon Chung, who did a phenomenal job in 10 years. The orchestra is playing at an extremely high level. They are very motivated. South Korea is an example of education as well, which explains the very high level of especially string playing. But in general, it's a very committed, very involved, very ambitious orchestra. I am very, very happy to be part of their next chapter for the moment.
Well, keep things going well in Utah. Keep the recordings coming and keep the great music making coming. I know you got to run. I close all my Cadenza interviews with two quick questions. You can answer them very quickly. The first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat, like we've been chatting, with someone from the past who you never had a chance to, when I asked that question, what's the first name that popped into your head?
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, Bach. A lot of conductors, it's Mahler, believe it or not. But Bach, Bach is the
I don't need to Mahler because he died in the 20th century. He's too close and we know so much about him. Bach, it's an internal inspiration without knowing a lot about him. We knew just a few things. And if your second question is, which composer would you take on a desert
island? No. That's
okay. But I would say Bach. That's why I answered so directly.
That's
to
fine.
Question.
Bach's the number one answer, and that's great. Yeah. Final question, a non-musical question. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You are busy. When you have to do something non-musical, take yourself away, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do when you need to just step away for a few minutes?
I run.
You run?
Jog, I mean, like running.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're in a great area for it. So,
fantastic. Yeah. Love it.
Conductors shouldn't need to run. You've got all that cardiovascular going with all your conducting. That's why you all live so long. But the running will let you go past 100. Thanks a lot, Terry Fisher. Thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure. Great to talking with you.
Maestro Terry Fisher. You can find out more about him at his website, Terry Fisher, TheierryFisher.com. And find out more about the Utah Symphony at utahsymphony.org. I'll leave you with this great Mahler Orchestra in their first recording in this maybe projected Mahler cycle being released on Reference Recordings. Check them out at referencerecordings.com. We'll hear the final minutes from the final movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 1. The Utah Symphony is led by their music director and my guest today, Terry Fisher. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.